just as an opening thought, have you ever noticed that there can be something that is nice but is torture at the same time? Now, what do I mean by that? Well, for example, when Julie and I first got married, we lived in a little apartment above a Christian bookstore in Pella, Iowa, a little Dutch town. And next to the bookstore was a bakery. And the small town Dutch bakeries, I mean, they're not Fleckenstein, but they're, you know, they're good stuff. And every morning we would wake up with the smells wafting up. And sometimes it was really nice, and at first we really liked it, but it made you want the real thing. You didn't want to sit there and go, okay, I just want the smell. No, you're like, I want to eat this thing. So we actually left Iowa because we would have gained a lot of weight. But there are a lot of things that kind of, they're nice, but they make you want the real thing, right? Like, you ever had somebody that you really miss, and you get an email or a letter or a phone call, or even you get a chance to Skype with them, and it's awesome to reconnect with them, but part of you, when you really care about somebody, says, I want the real thing. I want that person here, even though this is nice. Well, that's kind of a lot like the entire Old Testament. I mean, you know, there are several places in the New Testament where it says, look, this is all pointing forward. All of the Old Testament stuff was pointing forward to the coming Messiah, pointing to Jesus. And so the people of God in the Old Testament had this sense in which they're coming into God's presence in a way, and they're learning about God in a way, and they're experiencing His covenant love in a way, but in another way, they're going, man, this isn't a real thing yet. And so by the time Jesus shows up in the Bible, the people of Israel, God's people, they're really at a point where they're like, we want the real thing. In fact, for the last 400 years, they have had almost complete silence from God. And there have been all these messiahs, all these prophecies about the Messiah, and all these people pretending to be the Messiah. And so there are all kinds of conversation, all kinds of writing, all kinds of opinions about what was the Messiah going to be like? What was he going to look like? Who was he going to be? But God's people had a strong sense of, you know what, enough conversation, enough hints, enough prophecies. We want the real thing. Now, in a way, I think this is where most of us live. Actually, all of us live. We have this sense that there's something bigger than us. We have this sense that there's something going on. Even if you walk with God and you have a close relationship with Jesus, there's this sense that says, this is okay, this is even great sometimes, but there's part of my heart that longs for something bigger and something deeper and more permanent. And that's why there are those wonderful moments when somebody who's just a saint of God reaches the end of a long life and they're like, I'm ready to go home. You know what they're saying? They're saying, I want the real thing. I mean, the Bible makes it really clear. It says that God has placed eternity in our hearts. Another way that someone has said it is that God has placed in us a God-shaped void, and our hearts are restless until they find rest in Him. And even then, we're longing for something more. And just as much, maybe even more so, this is where Jesus' disciples lived. Now, before we get into Matthew, I want to kind of walk you through the life of Jesus, okay? So I hope you have time. But think of for a moment, before we look at the end of Jesus' life, about the disciples. They'd grown up looking for the Messiah. And they looked around them and they probably knew what we're experiencing doesn't really fully work for me. They're saying we're supposed to be God's people, but we're enslaved. I mean, we're under the rule of the Romans and we're persecuted. This is not the way it's supposed to be. They want the real thing. And then they'd become followers of Jesus. Think about these poor disciples. They'd been following for Jesus for 3 years and they really thought, okay, I think this is the Messiah. And, you know, considering that for 400 years, people have been waiting, they're probably going, we nailed it, you know. Other people have been asking questions and looking, but we're in the inner circle. But from the beginning, there was something they didn't understand. I mean, Matthew has made it clear that Jesus' entire life pointed to his death. And in a way, I guess we need to view this sermon series that we're in backwards. Because we've been talking about this changes everything. And first, Barry talked about the birth that changes everything. And we talked about how Jesus being born fulfilled all these prophecies. But in a way, you don't really understand Jesus' birth until later, and you look back. And you're, oh, that's what that was about. Or then you have the, Andy talked last week about the life that changes everything, and you look at Jesus' life, and it's pretty amazing, but you don't really understand it until you come to the end and you look back. And even today, as we look at the death that changes everything, we're going to realize that even the death of Christ doesn't fully make sense. We don't get it all until next week when we hear about the resurrection that changes everything. I mean, think about Jesus' life for a second. First, Jesus is born, and there are these wise men that come. And Mary knows that an angel appeared to her. She thinks something pretty amazing is going on. She believes that. But then these wise men show up when Jesus is probably still a toddler, and they bring some gifts. But the gifts are weird. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now, gold and frankincense don't make... I mean, those aren't really weird gifts. But myrrh. Myrrh is like what you use to treat a body after it dies. It's kind of like somebody shows up after you have a baby and they bring in and say, oh, here's what we got. We got some savings bonds to help support the child, you know, start a college fund, whatever. You're like, well, that's nice. And we brought some onesies. That's kind of nice. We'll enjoy that. And by the way, we also brought a bottle of embalming fluid. And you're going, okay, this is weird. But now we realize that's pointing ahead. So all the way through the time that they're following Jesus, the same sort of things are happening. Jesus is making general references to his death and to what his life is going to be like, but they don't seem to get it. I mean, just a couple of quick examples. In chapter 12, Jesus says, just as Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days, so the Son of Man will be in the belly of the earth for 3 days after he... What? Now, we can look back and say, well, that makes sense, but... The disciples had to say, wait, what? A lot. In chapter 16, he says, whoever would come after me must take up your cross daily and follow me. Take up your cross? Wait a minute. In fact, he hasn't really explained to them yet that he's going to die. And so they had to be going, what? Take up your cross? In chapter 17, he says, don't tell anyone who I am until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. They're going, raised from the dead? Later in chapter 17, he gets really blunt, and I love this. It's chapter 17 of Matthew. There's several examples, but I think this is a great one. 17:22, this is what Jesus says. He says, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and on the third day, he will be raised to life. Pretty straightforward, right? But they clearly don't get it. In fact, their most common response seems to be something along these lines. Jesus says, I'm going to die. And they go, later they're kind of off in a little corner going, what do you think he meant by the fact that he said he's going to die? And I wonder if any of the disciples said, well, I think he meant he's going to die. But they don't get it. Other times, they rebuke him. You know, Peter rebukes him for saying that, which takes some courage to rebuke the Son of God. In Matthew 20, he makes it clear again. He says, look, this is the way it's going to be. I'm going to die. I'm going to be mocked and flogged and crucified. And then right after that, the mother of James and John, who I don't know why, I guess she was the first helicopter mom ever, shows up and she says, hey, Jesus, can my boys be like on your right and your left? Now, honestly, moms, how many of you would be like, hey, Jesus, I know you're going to be crucified, so can my boys go with you? Apparently, she's heard this, and she isn't getting it. And then Holy Week comes, and it gets even more intense. Today's Palm Sunday. A lot of the time we talk about how Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey, and up to this point, you kind of have this sense, if you read the Gospels, that they're like, okay, we're going to Jerusalem, and there are a lot of people that believe the Messiah was going to set them free. He was going to overturn the Romans. Everything was going to be great. And so they're going to Jerusalem. They're like, okay, we're going to ride in there. We're going to be like the A-team, you know, coming to the rescue. It's going to be great. And he rides in on a donkey. Now, I know that sometimes conquering generals in those days would come in on a donkey, but that was after they conquered. In fact, the Bible makes it pretty clear that the donkey is about humility. And these disciples, I mean, honestly, if you're a disciple and you're thinking, this guy that we're following is going to be the leader of my nation, you're going, okay, triumphant entry, and he's riding on a donkey. But then, Jesus comes in and he starts to do some exciting stuff. He confronts the wrong people. He goes to the temple and he starts trashing the temple. Now, wait a minute. The disciples had to be saying, what are you doing, Jesus? You're supposed to overturn the Romans. You're fighting our own people. He tells stories that totally offend everybody. He tells a parable during the Holy Week about, you know, a landowner who goes away and then he sends his son and all the workers kill him. And they're like, that's obviously about us. I don't like that. He tells another story about this man who holds a huge banquet and he invites his people, the right people, you know, the Israelites, right? And they refuse. And he says, fine, we'll let everybody else come. If you're a disciple of Jesus at this point, you're going, this is not the way it's supposed to play. And then he tells them that they will be persecuted and killed. Not just him, but them. And, you know, you can almost picture the conversation where, you know, they come up to Jesus and they, Jesus, when you said persecuted and killed, those are like code words for like honored and cheered, right? No, and then, so it's funny because if you read through this, it's like Jesus gets more and more blunt. Okay, like parents, you ever have this with your kids where you're telling something and you're trying to be subtle? Or maybe a better example, wives. You ever try to tell your husband something and you're trying to be subtle and we just don't get it? And finally you're like, look, this is what I'm saying. In chapter 26, he says, as you know, the Passover is 2 days away, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified. He's not just saying this is what's going to happen. He's saying this is when it's going to happen. And then later in that chapter, this woman anoints him with perfume, and they're all upset, and he says, oh, it's okay. She's anointed me for burial. Then he gets up at the Last Supper, and he says, this is my body and my blood, which is broken for you. Do you kind of get where they'd be at this point? And do you ever feel that way? You ever feel like, man, when I became a Christian, I thought it was going to be good. I thought I was going to be a better person. I thought things were going to be all right. But, you know, maybe you accepted Christ and you thought your family was going to get better and your family fell apart. You know, I've known people that have come to know Christ and they're like, okay, my life is going to be fixed now, but the person they're married to says, I didn't want to marry. I wasn't married to this Jesus freak person. Then he gets arrested, and Peter does something that seems kind of heroic. He says, oh, I'm going to fight for it. I mean, there's an entire group of people here, soldiers, and Peter pulls out his sword to defend Jesus. Courageous. And Jesus rebukes him and heals the guy's ear. Peter's going, I don't know what to do. And then there's a sham of a trial, trumped up charges, false witnesses. And we come to Matthew 27, starting at verse 32. This is what it says. As they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. They came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. There they offered Jesus wine to drink mixed with gall, but after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they had crucified him, and you know what that means, right? They had already beaten him to the point that he was barely recognizable as a human being, and they lay him on this wooden thing, and they drive basically railroad spikes through his hands and his feet. And they jam a crown of thorns on his head. When they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Above his head, they placed the written charge against him. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Notice the sarcasm. This is Jesus, King of the Jews. Two robbers were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come on down from the cross if you are the Son of God." This is the Son of God, the perfect sinless man who has lived a life of love and service and has already given every moment of his life for other people in love. And he has been beaten and stripped and humiliated and spit on and mocked. In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. He saved others, but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. You hear that? If he wants him. For he said, "I am the Son of God." In the same way, the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Because at this moment, in order for Jesus' death to have its full meaning, his Father has left him. When some of those standing there heard this, they said, "He's calling Elijah." Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. Now, there's a lot we could say leading up to this. But hear this next part. Jesus died. And I just said that this is the death that changes everything, but it hasn't really changed much. At this moment, he's dead. There's no sense of victory. I mean, John tells us that Jesus cried out his last thing. In Matthew, it just says he called out. He cried out in a loud voice. John says he yelled, "Tetelestai," which is, "It is finished." And we understand now, if you've grown up in church, that that was a cry of victory. But do you think it felt that way to the people in the crowd? Ha! It's finished. He's done. He has lost. Don't read back into this yet, what we know in hindsight. Sure, he'd predicted his death, but now he's dead. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of cool to say, wow, he predicted this and now he's there. But how does that feel if you're a disciple? I mean, if you had a dear friend who was always saying, "You know what, eventually I'm going to get hit by a car and I'm going to die." And then one day they get hit by a car and they died. Would you be like, "Wow, good for you, you were right"? Look at the next couple of verses. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. Look at verse 51. At that moment, The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. Now, let's step back 2,000 years and understand what that means. You see, Golgotha was a hill, and the temple sat on the highest hill of Jerusalem. So they would have been able to see the temple. And in fact, the temple was divided into a couple different sections. There was the courtyard, and then from the courtyard you'd go into the holy place, which is kind of like, that's, you know, the fellowship hall is the courtyard, and this is the holy place, okay? That's kind of where they went to worship. But then, inside that, there was the Holy of Holies. And separating the holy place from the most holy place was a 60-foot high curtain. A 60-foot high curtain, 30 feet wide, and actually it was about 4 inches thick. It was all this woven stuff, weighed an incredible amount, and it was visible from anywhere around there. And at the moment that Jesus dies, this curtain, which symbolizes the fact that God, who dwells back in the most holy, in the Holy of Holies, is in some way separate from His people. And it's torn in top, from the top to the bottom. Not bottom to the top, you know, as a man would do it, because we'd grab the bottom. No, it's from the top down, from heaven to earth, it's torn in half. What in the world does that mean? Well, I got to tell you, it means everything. This one detail, this one verse, when you understand kind of where it comes from, summarizes so much of what Jesus did for us on the cross. Now, I want to spend some time in Hebrews 9 here, and I'm not really going to read a lot of this, but I think it'd be useful for you to go back and read this. Hebrews 9 describes what was there in the temple, in the earthly tabernacle. And this is what they describe. There's a holy place. The holy place, in the holy place there were a couple things. One was a lampstand. I'll tell you what, let's call this our lampstand, okay? It's our lampstand. And it symbolizes God's presence, okay? And in fact, it would have been a burning fire. Imagine that there's kind of a light in there. And when the people had wandered in the wilderness, there'd been this pillar of fire that had traveled with them at night and a pillar of smoke during the day. But it symbolized God's presence. And so this lampstand was there, and the people knew that's to symbolize the fact that God is back there behind the curtain. There was also consecrated bread. As long as they're having communion, let's say this is the bread. And the bread, what's called the showbread, was a reminder of God's provision that God had provided for them. Again, when they'd wandered in the wilderness, God had sent manna. And so they said, okay, this lampstand reminds us that God is with us. And then there's the bread, and that reminds us that God will provide. And then there's a couple other things. Back in the Holy of Holies, there's an altar of incense, and we'll call this our incense, okay? And so that would kind of remind the people that it was kind of the prayers going up to God. Like, if I were to light this candle, there'd be smoke going up. And so they're like, okay, there's all these visual reminders that God is going to provide, that God is with us, that God is listening, that God hears our prayers. But you know what? Those are just symbols. They weren't real, really. It's kind of like the smell of the donuts. They were the smell, they weren't the donuts. So back in the Holy of Holies, there was the Ark of the Covenant. You've seen the Indiana Jones movies, you know what that looked like, which is actually a fairly accurate rendering. On top of the Ark of the Covenant was a mercy seat, a seat. And that seat symbolized the fact that God would forgive them. And so there are all these children's sermons, you know, all these object lessons to remind them of what was going on. But they didn't even see the mercy seat. It was back there. They knew it was back there. They knew that somewhere behind the curtain there was forgiveness and wholeness. That was the place where the blood would be applied In fact, the Holy of Holies was so separate that once a year, on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the high priest would enter. This is the high priest, the most righteous, holy guy in the entire nation, chosen by God. Some accounts say that they would actually tie a rope to his leg, because if he went in there and he touched the ark or he did anything back there and he was unworthy, he hadn't done all the rituals he was supposed to do, they believed he would actually be struck dead. And they had a rope on his leg so they could pull him out in case he was struck dead, because they're like, I'm not going in there. Are you going in? I'm not. In fact, let me just give you a little bit of description. This is the most holy guy to start with, but this is what he would do to get ready. A week beforehand, the high priest was put in seclusion, taken away from his home and into the place where he was completely alone. Why? So he wouldn't accidentally touch or eat anything unclean. Clean food was brought to him, and throughout the week, he'd wash his body and prepare his heart over and over. The night before the Day of Atonement, he didn't go to bed. He stayed up all night praying and reading God's Word to purify his soul. Then on Yom Kippur, he bathed again, head to toe, dressed in pure, unstained white linen. Then he went into the Holy of Holies and offered an animal sacrifice to God, or to atone or pay for the penalty for his own sins. Then he came back out, because he's just taking care of his own sins. He came back out, bathed completely again, put a new white linen on, and he went in again, this time sacrificing for the sins of the priests. That's not all. He'd come out again, bathe again, be redressed again, and then they would send him back into the Holy of Holies to atone for the sin of the people. You see how seriously they took this? And this is the only guy that could ever go in there. This was all done in public. The temple was crowded. Those in attendance watched closely. There was a thin screen, and he bathed behind it for modesty purposes. But the people were present. They saw him bathe. They saw him dress, go in, back out, go in, back out. He was their representative before God, and they were cheering him on because they believed that any forgiveness they would have, any purity, any connection with God they would ever have was completely separate from them. It was all on this guy's shoulders, and he was going behind the curtain. But in Hebrews chapter 9, he kind of describes this, all the things that are going on and all the things that are there, all the object lessons. But this is what chapter 9, verse 9 of Hebrews says. This is an illustration for the present time, indicating that the gifts and sacrifices being offered were not able to clear the conscience of the worshiper. They are only a matter of food and drink and various ceremonial washings, external regulations applying until the time of the new order. In other words, it didn't really fix it. They were doing what God had called them to do, and these symbols were important, and they were reminded, God is with us, and God hears us, and God is going to provide, and God is merciful. But all this stuff is just symbols because we believe that something's going to happen. And you know what? The deepest needs of every person are symbolized in these things, aren't they? God's presence, don't we all want to have some sense of connection to something bigger than ourselves? Even people who are atheists have this desire to connect with something bigger. The bread, God's provision, we all want to know that we're going to have what we need. We all want to be heard. We all want to be forgiven. In fact, we all want to know that we're okay when we stand before God. But God has been telling them, and they already knew that these rituals didn't do it. He promised something greater. It's not going to ultimately be about the blood of goats and rams. When I first learned to drive, I learned to drive on an 18-year-old pickup that had been given to us, and it had been painted by the local community college. And it was a four on the floor, so it had first, second, third, and fourth gear, but first and third didn't really work. Okay? And reverse worked sometimes. And it had a wooden base in the back, a wooden floor, in the bed, which was basically rotting out. So occasionally you'd step in the back and your foot would go through the bed of the pickup. In the front, underneath the pedals, it had also rusted out, and so we'd riveted into place a metal dinner tray to cover the hole there. And you know, sometimes you could actually see the road going by underneath. And that's what I learned to drive in. That was not what a pickup was supposed to be. And there was some sense when you're driving it, you're thinking, there's something better than this. Now, I still don't have the new better pickup, but that's what the people of Israel were saying. There's something better than this. In fact, look at Hebrews 9, verses 11 through 15. When Christ came as the high priest of the good things that are already here, He went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle that is not man-made, that is to say, not a part of this creation. He did not enter by the means of blood and of goats and calves, but He entered the most holy place once for all by His own blood, having obtained eternal redemption. The blood and blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkled on those who are unclean sanctify them so they are outwardly clean. How much more then will the blood of Christ, which through the eternal Spirit offered Himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death, so that we may serve the living God. For this reason, Christ is the mediator of a new covenant, that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, now that He has died as a ransom to set them free from the sins committed before under the first covenant. Do you hear that? What it's saying is, all this stuff was good. It was people trying hard to be what God wanted them to be, but all this stuff wasn't quite working. They were waiting for what was going to come, and Jesus came, and when He died, not drug in like a sacrificed animal, but by His own choice, not deserving to die, but because He was willing to die out of love, He said, you know what? You want God's presence? Because of Jesus' death on the cross, that is torn in half, and all of a sudden, God is with His people, and His people are with God, and all of that is new. We don't yell at God from a distance. The veil was torn, and God was with His people. The bread, it's funny, and Jesus also said, what is it? I am the light of the world. And there was this bread that symbolized God's provision. You know what Jesus also said? I am the bread of life. Because I have torn this veil apart, God is with you and providing. God is hearing. The Bible makes it very clear that, you know, can you imagine how hard it was to hear through a 4-inch thick cloth? Because Christ died, we are invited in. We don't pray from a distance. And the mercy seat, forgiveness. Because the blood of Christ, because Jesus gave His life on the cross, we can face our own guilt and our eternity without fear. Let's think about guilt as we close. See, our society tends to blur the line between feeling guilty and being guilty. You know, people are like, well, I don't feel guilty, so I'm not guilty. And we lower the bar as low as possible. You know, if you ask somebody, well, do you think you're a good person? Well, I'm not Hitler. I'm going, oh, so that's the standard. You get to go to heaven, and you're good enough for God as long as you're not Hitler. Let me ask you, friends, and I ask myself this. Do you really believe that your thoughts, your actions, your motives, all of that, are worthy of a perfect, holy, righteous, all-powerful God? You know, even the best things I do are often selfish. Sometimes I'm nice to my wife because I want her to be nice to me. Sometimes we give gifts to people because we're supposed to, or because they gave a gift to us. It's the expectation. In fact, psychologists talk about what they call covert guilt. Covert guilt is this sense that apparently everybody in the human race has that says, I don't know if I'm inadequate. Psychologists can't explain it, that we're just like, I'm inadequate. I'm not good enough. The Bible explains it. It says that Adam and Eve ate from the apple and they realized they were naked and they realized they were unworthy. Would you like it if everyone knew your darkest secret? That thing you did maybe years ago? You're like, I'm glad no one here knows that I did that. That ongoing struggle that you have that you can't overcome. The things you think when you let your mind wander. The anger, the selfishness, the lust, the hatred. Anybody want to get up here and just kind of tell us about all that in your own life? At least six times in the Gospels, there's some variation of this statement. Jesus knew what was in the heart of a man. And at the moment that Jesus died, that curtain was torn in two. And we say, but I'm not worthy. And Jesus says, you're right. But he is. There's a story about a father who would come home from work every day. And he had a little girl. She's about 3 years old. And every day, no matter how his day was, his little girl would come running out and just meet him. He wouldn't even get out of his car. And she'd come running out the door. And she'd be like, Daddy! Daddy! And he knew that no matter how his day had been, that his daughter was going to welcome him home. And so that was a daily thing. And then one day, he came home and she came running out and said, Daddy, Daddy, you're home. I love you. And he says, well, I love you too. And he said, I have a gift for you. And he took out a package out of his coat. And she opened it up. They tore it open. And inside was poppies. Now, I put a picture of poppies up here so you'll know what I mean. Remember poppies? Little cheap plastic things. But that little girl loved those poppies more than anything. And so Daddy would come home from work, and she'd come running out, and she'd have her poppies around her neck, and she'd say, Daddy, Daddy, I love you. And he'd say, I love you too. But after a few days, there came a day when he said, I love you too. If you love me, will you give me your poppies? And she looked at him, and her eyes filled with tears, and she said, but Daddy, I love my poppies. He said, if you love me, you'll give me your poppies. And she squirms out of his arms, and she runs inside, and she runs in, and she closes her door. And the next day, he comes home, and no little girl comes out. And the next day, no little girl comes out. And finally, on the third day, he comes home, and he pulls in and the door opens, but she doesn't come running out. Can you picture the little three-year-old girl kind of walk in and dirt and tears on her face? And she walks up to her dad and says, Daddy, I love you. Here are my poppies. And he reaches into his coat and he pulls out a smaller package. And they open it and inside are a string of pearls. Folks, our lives are filled with the things that we do to be close to God. And in some level, they're not bad things, but they're poppies. And when Jesus died and that veil was torn, the curtain was torn in two, the message to us was, you can let go of those cheap plastic toys. I have something for you that is so much more valuable. We're going to take communion in a moment here. And in a way, I hate to say this, but communion's a pop bead. It's a symbol. It's the smell. It's not the donuts. That'd be kind of fun, though, if we had donuts. Anyway, I distracted myself. It's a symbol of the fact that there is something infinitely more valuable that has been offered to us through the blood and body of Jesus. And so as we come forward for this, I just encourage you to look beyond the symbol and enter into the Holy of Holies.